Joe Lowry. Welcome to another episode of the Global Lithium Podcast. My guest today is Chris Reed, who runs Neo Metals. Chris has been on the podcast before. He, along with Neo Metals COO Mike Tamlin, were on episode 3. And that is the second most listened to podcast of the now 77 episodes. And we're going to talk about his transition from simply being involved in spodumene and the lithium upstream to moving into urban mining. Neo Metals will be able to produce battery quality cobalt, nickel, and lithium from both batteries that have reached the end of their useful life and startup material from gigafactories. In the process of the gigafactory build-out, just as we see lithium projects that have a ramp-up period, we'll see a similar scenario in the gigafactory battery build-out. There will be a lot of off-spec batteries made, and the best way to deal with the off-spec batteries and the valuable raw materials inside them is to run them through a recycling process. In urban mining, the initial focus will be on the more valuable raw materials. That would be cobalt and nickel. Lithium will also be mined, but we'll hear some subtleties regarding how you'll look at urban mine materials on the cost curve. Urban mining will be a good solution for Europe that has a dearth of lithium resources, but will be a large market in the future, given the lofty goals the EU has for EV penetration. It will be very positive from an ESG standpoint to support urban mining as a complement to the conversion capacity that will be built out in the near future as part of the EU's goal to no longer be dependent on Asia for their battery and raw material supply. It's going to be a big challenge for the EU. Their goals are probably too lofty. It will need to be a combination of regionalization and interdependence with other areas of the world that produce the raw material. But certainly, urban mining is a big piece of the policy in the future for Europe. We will also talk about Neo Metals' plans to build a lithium hydroxide plant in India, which seems like a great opportunity given India's future potential in both e-transport and ESS. I consider Chris Reed one of the most agile minds and forward-thinking people in the battery metal space. I've learned a lot from my interactions over the years with Chris, and I'm very happy to be able to bring him back to the Global Lithium Podcast audience. And without further ado, Chris Reed.
You're listening to the Global Lithium Podcast.
This episode of the Global Lithium Podcast is sponsored by Zalandez, a brinefield services company providing real-time, actionable data. Zalandez recently saved a major lithium brine producer up to 50% in their drilling costs and increased brine well production rates by as much as 40%. Find out more at Zalandez.com.
Chris Reed, welcome to another episode of the Global Lithium Podcast.
It's my pleasure.
You were guest number 3, and after 75 episodes, your episode with Mike Tamlin is still number 2, only bested by the legend Dr. Bertrand, who for some odd reason got 80,000 downloads, which for a lithium podcast makes no sense at all. But yes, your episode is number 2, and I'm expecting this one to be very well received. Let's kick it off with, when we last talked, you were in the midst of Mount Marion had started up. It was about spodumene and WA. You have made a very profitable exit from Mount Marion, but retained some offtake rights in case you need product going forward. But What is your assessment? We saw several mines come online very quickly. The EV party is really still in its early days, and saw the price drop precipitously and put the new operations under pressure. What's your take on where we are right now and what kind of pricing we need to keep WA viable as the main lithium supplier basically in the world?
Yeah, look, thanks, Joe. Yeah, I guess, you know, we were early in and we led the first big development sort of since Greenbushes and brought Mount Marion into production. And then for our share, we were the first out. I studied mineral economics postgrad at the School of Mines. So, you know, you sit down there and you ignore demand and supply at your own peril. We had good visibility that in our wake, we enabled some of the other aspirants to sort of dovetail behind us and bring their projects into production. And then one of our partners acquired an asset that we were quite confident would have been, other than Greenbushes, our biggest competitor. And I think when you see that on the wall, if you're the smallest party, you know, for us, it makes sense to exit stage left. You know, we first acquired the rights for Mount Marion in 2009, and we started aggressively developing that project in 2010 and putting plant on site and clearing. And then in 2011 started the lithium war. So we had been through the tail end of a cycle where I think we find ourselves, we're past the tail end of the cycle. We're clearly closer to the bottom than the top. I firmly have the belief that we are bumping along the bottom in today's paper in the West Australian, the lithium producers, the spodumene producers are now appealing to the government for royalty relief, which says to them, if they think that can make a margin or save them, they're probably cash neutral. I think stockpiled mineral concentrates somewhere around 100,000 tons of LCE. And, you know, that's significant. And then plus the 100,000 tons of stockpiled LCE as cons, you know, mainly six, but admittedly some four, there is production capacity offline. You have Wodgina, you have a large part of Pilbara. Greenbushes, I think, you know, from what I can tell about the export figures, you know, in the last four quarters, Mount Marion's produce more than Greenbushes and two of them. So they're clearly not at full utilization rates. And so there's somewhere between 150,000 to 200,000 tons LCE of spod offline. In China, I reckon there's 125 to 150,000 tons of LCE of converting capacity offline. You know, and so what is, you know, and it's no wonder that the spodumene price has fallen, the chemical price has fallen. There still remain some quality issues in some sectors, you know, of the market. So, yeah, look, we find ourselves in an oversupply of spod and chemical, and that's going to take a little while to work itself out.
Last time I saw you in Perth, we're talking about the first million tons, and you quickly said, well, nobody's talking about the second million tons. And that's kind of where I come back to, yeah, we're in a brief period oversupply, but in a time when we have 2% EV penetration, we had several mines come on at once, which you're probably not going to see that again for a while. And when we look at 2025 or 2026 to the million tons, it was just a couple of years ago, the Atacama was convincing everybody they could do 400,000 tons. And now it looks like maybe 200,000 tons in 2025. SQM reported today they're basically going to be stuck on the same number they were at 2016 this year, sales-wise, about a little less than 50,000 tons. Now they're claiming they're going to do 70,000 tons. But in 2017, they said they'd have 120,000 tons last year. And now they've moved it out to 21 and saying that by 2025, they'll have 150. I guess the point I'm making is if we look at the entirety of South America in a million ton world, South America by 25 is probably only going to be able to do at best 300,000 between Argentina and Chile. So when you take a step back and look at all the excess that you have inventory-wise and look at the market as being a million tons and 700,000 of it probably has to come from the combination of WA and China, I think that pretty well cleans things out. I actually think because South America can probably only do about 60 to 65% battery quality right now, that you're also going to have a fairly significant amount of capacity in China that reprocesses. So I don't know how you feel about all that, but I actually think the market will start to be tight again within 2 years on the high end. I won't talk to the low end, but on the battery for high quality hydroxide, and I know you have an interest in this because you still have plans at some point to be a hydroxide producer, but where do you see the next 5 years from a chemical perspective?
Yeah, look, I've got to say, Joe, in terms of the brines, you know, we've done a little bit of work in direct extraction, and obviously we've got a patented lithium chloride electrolysis tech. And we saw that as perhaps what they needed to get to this battery grade hydroxide that they aspire to. And look, we need them to be perfectly clear. But I think you have a look at history. I mean, you know how long it took FMC to ramp up Hombre Muerto. You have a look at Orocobre, La Negra 2, the latest SQM expansions. It's not easy. And these are multi-billion-dollar multinational chemical companies with superb pedigrees, right? It's not easy. And the latest development lack, and you know, you've got great technicians that have come out of some of those organizations, and obviously you've got the excellent skills from the people at Ganfeng that will help make that. They'll almost guarantee that is a success. But they can't expect to do anything wildly different than the incumbent producers. You know, I think your number of 300,000 out of a million tons by 2025 that sounds to me about right. And so that then leaves largely Australia to step up by 2025. I don't think we can get any of the African deposits up, maybe thereabouts, but all the Australians are going to have to, we'll be at full capacity to deliver 700,000 tons of LCE. That's 4.9 odd million tons of spod. The backbone of that would have to be Greenbushes and Tianji, and I keep calling them Rockwood, but it's Albemarle. They would have to finish the construction of phase three and ramp that up, and that's 2.4 at theoretical max. I mean, they will munch through the ore body at that rate. Wodgina can do 750. Mount Marion, they can tickle that up to probably over 500. Ken's going to have to step up with his expansions. Kathleen Valley's going to have to come on. West Farmers SQM are going to have to bring on Mount Holland. So look, you know, but you'd have to be writing, you'd have to have an open checkbook, and you'd have to be funding those sort of things now. And if the brine boys want to meet the market, that'd have to be opening the checkbook and investing now. And I don't see it. If anything, they've all wound back and constrained their spending. And look, as you're heading into what could be the first global depression in 90 years, that probably is the right thing to do. But the victim will be, I agree, we're going to be short of battery grade hydroxide sooner rather than later. But that's not all the market. But it's certainly a very important part. Where we see ourselves, I reckon, at the moment with the market is we've never had better clarity on where demand is going. We've got good line of sight on the build out of these battery plants, use varying amounts of nickel and cobalt, but you need to have them in, more nickel and cobalt, obviously. And the lithium sort of, you can't substitute it in a lithium ion battery plant. So we can see where demand's going. And I'm still at a loss how we ramp up in an orderly fashion to get to a million from 300 and something thousand capacity now, let alone it's almost impossible to see where we get to two. And we're going to need to be at two by 2030.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was a conversation we had the last time I was in Perth, and even with the lower prices, and this is what really interests me, is that till June, Korea and Japan, hydroxide's still over 12, and carbonate's still around 11,000 a ton.
Yeah, and it's really good.
Quality matters. If this was just a fungible good, you would be going to the least common denominator pretty quickly. And the least common denominator is pretty, I mean, Auric Cobre to me is the bellwether, because during the shortage, they got a premium to Albemarle in the sweet spots because they were the last mile of supply. Even on the industrial side, they were getting 13,000. And now they're getting less than four. Their Q2 report was 39.13. And we've seen the same thing happen to SQM because they are having, they don't like to acknowledge it, but they're clearly having quality problems. I don't know, with COVID and pushing back demand a little bit, I don't know when the spike comes, but say it's not till 23. I think once it happens, you're going to have higher prices for years because it's going to, the investment's not happening. I mean, when you have Albemarle backing off, when you have Livent saying, well, we need incentive pricing to do this expansion. You know, I guess that's the other thing. You've traveled a lot. You've talked to a lot of people. You're playing in more than the upstream now. Where do you see the OEM role? I've always characterized the car companies pretty much as bullies to suppliers. And, you know, I don't think that's an unfair characterization.
I would say that's very accurate, Joe.
And in the case of lithium, you see somebody like a Volkswagen or a BMW, and they do a strategic agreement with Ganfeng, but Ganfeng's only given any one company 20% of their hydroxide capacity. And when you look at their EV plans, that's a drop in the bucket.
Yeah, every journey starts with a step. Absolutely. But I think these car makers have never had to worry about the fuel that goes in the car.
Yeah.
And not only now do they have to worry about the fuel that goes in the car, i.e. the battery, they've got to worry about the carbon footprint of the electrons. If we're trying to decarbonize transport and reduce the footprint. You know, the BMW Ganfeng transaction, you know, you've got to look through long-term price there, and it's not dissimilar to the numbers that you just quoted. That is a price that is needed for the Ganfeng guys to make an acceptable return and to incentivize them to build out more capacity for BMW. And we're below that point. I mean, you know, one of your earlier questions, which I conveniently dodged until now, is what is the incentive price for spodumene? And so, you know, at the moment, you're looking at a CIF price or CFR price into China of 375 to 400. Certainly when we developed Mount Marion, 440 was prevailing price. And we could make an acceptable return. I mean, we actually had a floor price that we could rely on. The people that did have them apparently don't. And take or pay clearly is not what it used to be. You know, I would say that cash flow generation would be negligible. On an all-in basis, you'd be losing some money, albeit that you would have already sunk that capital. What do I think would be a minimum? I mean, I think at 550 US, I think that would be something where people would be comfortable investing large amounts of capital, and that the financiers would be comfortable lending money in the quantum that's needed to deliver the production that's required. We're a fair way off that at present. And like I said, you know, the equivalent of more or less 700 to 750,000 tons of SC6 cotton stockpiled, it's not likely to pick up anytime soon. In fact, what you need is you need the Chinese converters to go off care and maintenance for them to build out the rest of their pipeline. And they've got a good pipeline, but the government did the right thing in slowing down the build out. Unfortunately, some of the Australians have become white slaves, but it's economics. Sometimes, I mean, we were making abnormal profits for a good period of time.
When Anthony C was able to get the price up to 950 for that brief season, if that was the knee-jerk reaction to, we're the first guys back online, And so we can do this, but how long did that last? I think it lasted about a year, and then price started to tumble back to earth. Good for Anthony that they were able to leverage Mount Catlin for a little while, but that wasn't real, and 375 isn't real either. And that's what I'm interested in seeing, is a real price for spodumene become apparent. Then you can do the cost curve. Then you can derive what your high cost capacity is pretty easily. I think it all leads back to low, certainly over 10,000 a ton, probably closer to 12. And if you're in China and you're going to export to Korea and Japan, you've got the VAT issue to look at too. So we're not there right now, but let's talk about happier topics. I think started looking at lithium, I think you said in 2008, which was probably about the worst possible year to start. If you were going to look at an industry, 2009 was the first year in my career that lithium demand went down. You persevered through that. You got the project going, you got good partners, and you moved on and you got out. So we're now in another difficult situation, and you're looking at other businesses. Tell me about how you see the recycling opportunity. We did talk a little bit last time about urban mining. I find it a fascinating topic because it has to happen. But how do you see it playing out for Neo Metals, and then more broadly, if you go 5 or 10 years down the road?
Yeah.
How's it go?
So I think, you know, once you get a project, invest a lot of money, and then you go into a price war for a couple of years, Joe, you know, we were in 11, 12, 13. We had a fair bit of time to contemplate our navel and actually work out where we wanted to be in the supply chain. And we realized that whilst being integrated was going to be more sustainable in the long term, it soon became apparent that the root cause of the driver was the EVs and the battery production or the cell production. And in that process, the typical scrap rates are around 10%. Now, some of the Korean guys say it's 5%. Certainly when they start these plants, it's about 30% scrap. And so we started up Mount Marion in 2015. They started constructing that, and we started migrating our attention to the other end. And it's a bit like in 2000, if you knew that the Chinese were going to consume so much steel and build so much blast furnaces, you would have worked out that the majors couldn't possibly supply the iron ore and coking coal that you needed, and you would have got into that market. We saw something similar with lithium, but we didn't quite get the timing right. We got it right for the second wave, but we didn't get it right in the first wave. We couldn't have got it right because we'd started just a little bit late. We know how many battery plants are being built, and we haven't got to focus on China, because the Ganfeng guys have got a 100,000 ton plant up there, and I like Jiaxin too much to compete against him, and he's much bigger than me. And so we've focused on Europe, which will become the second biggest battery making hub outside of East Asia. And there is, and so we sized the plant, and we did it in stages. So for a gigafactory sort of size plant, 35 gigawatt hours, you would make enough out of the production scrap. So off-spec cathode, jelly rolls, cuttings, failed cells and packs on the QAQC, enough to fill a 20,000 ton plant. And then you would naturally have to scale that up if you were in a good relationship and you agreed to share the economics with the cell maker or the car maker to recycle the end of life, and hence scale that up to 200,000 tons. So we basically sat down here in Australia, tried a couple of different flow sheets, found one that worked, that we liked, but essentially based on solvent extraction that was invented in Mount Isa in the copper industry. And so what we do is, one, you've got to make the batteries safe to process. So, you know, we had to come up with a shredding, a safe shredding, because you remember the old book, Canned Lightning. And I tell you what, some of those things can pack a punch. And so we can safely shred it, put it in an acidic solution, solvent extract out all the payables, and give them back what they want. One, it's got to be safe. Two, with a low footprint. And three, they want high purity ingredients that they can reinsert back into the supply chain that have a very, very small carbon footprint. That's sort of the genesis of how we designed our process. And so originally we looked at 20,000 tons would be enough for a 35 gigawatt hour plant. Now in Europe, they're at over 500 gigawatt hours of plant capacity online in the second half of this decade. So once again, we're early movers. We've de-risked the flow sheet. We ran a pilot plant for almost a year up in at XGS Lakefield in Canada. They did a great job. And then essentially we partnered with project delivery guys like we did with Mineral Resources, except this time we've done it with SMS Group, who are a 130-year-old privately owned German group, 14,000 employees in 95 sites around the world. They're one of the largest builders of processing plants and headquartered in Germany. And if you're going to target battery recycling, Germany is the epicenter of the cell making capacity. And although we think we've got a good product and we might be nice people, but these guys are massive businesses and due respect, they probably can't take the risk with us. And they also want to, if anything goes wrong, speech German to a German. So hence we partnered with the Germans.
So the laws in the EU, if I have heard properly, it basically cradle to grave on the battery, which has to help you.
We've got tailwinds like you wouldn't believe.
And when you look at the competitive environment for that, you're in with one of the biggest builders of that type of plant, I guess that's a tailwind. But who do you see as your biggest competition?
So largely the incumbent guys there are in sort of pyrometallurgy, which Europe obviously has a long history of, all the way back to the Bronze Age. And so whilst it's not the certain recovery rates are suggested but not legally enforced yet, you can go for pyrometallurgy, right? I mean, you recover a mixed metal, dirty metal button. You incinerate the graphite, you incinerate the electrolyte, you incinerate the plastic. So, you know, 50%+ mass has gone straight up the stack and you got to scrub it. So it is recycled, so you can tick the recycling box, but it's at less than 50%, I would say it's recovery, and the lithium's gone. So in the hydrometallurgy world, you'll recall that what used to be Chemetall, the Chemetall part of Rockwood, had that litho-rec process for a number of years that was funded by the German government with a lot of the technical unis. They ended up abandoning that, and that's gone. I believe that's migrated into Dusenfeld. And so certainly in our freedom to operate and novelty searches, we occasionally, their literature comes up. So I would say on a flow sheet basis, they're probably the closest. They've recently announced a deal with BMW where they're going to try to get 85% recovery, which is where we're at. They're going to try to get up to 96%. BMW is in the Dow Jones Sustainability Index and they've got to recycle 85% of the car. Now, whilst the EV fleet's a small percentage of the overall fleet, you can do pyrometallurgy, but in time, everyone will have to migrate to hydrometallurgy. The old hatch boys at Lysicle, they're in the US. They're pretty handy guys. They know what they're doing. They originally started with a mixed metal oxide, but heading to high purity sulfate, so you can go straight into the cathode stream. And then everyone's sort of looking at it. We've had the fortunate position that we've been now looking. This is our fourth year in the process. We're at the moment in the some parts of our equipment we've commissioned. We will have Europe's largest shredding plant. It's currently on the water. It'll be in Hamburg next week, before going down into SMS's facilities. That'll have a 20,000 ton throughput. We had that built in the Midwest in the US. We've commissioned the dryer and initially, so 2 ton an hour front end is sort of commercial scale. And the demonstration plant will be 2 tons a day feed rate in the hydrometallurgy. And then as we secure commercial contracts, we will scale that up.
And when you look at the economics of that, obviously lithium is not leading the charge. You know, I had a conversation with Sumitomo Metal Mining a couple of years ago about the economics of recycling. And at the time, and I don't know, we didn't even get into their process, but they were just talking about the future. And they said that they make sense to go after the lithium as long as lithium sold for more than $9 a kilo. What kind of numbers are you looking at for lithium? Because lithium is kind of the marginal value in this scheme, I would say.
Yeah, look, mate, absolutely. 80% is the cobalt and nickel sulfates in terms of the revenue drivers. Lithium is important. Now, we use a sulfuric medium. So it drops out as a lithium sulfate. We can keep that in solution and we can carbonate it or causticize it, which is typical in the spodumene conversion process. You know, going from an oxide to a sulfate to either hydroxide or carbonate. So our focus has just been making the lithium sulfate. Once you make the lithium sulfate, you know, it's not technically that challenging to turn that into a more battery-ready lithium salt.
So when you look at your hydroxide plant, in the New World Order, what your offtake from Mount Marion's really... It's nice, but it's not enough to drive probably the scale of a hydroxide plant you'd want going forward.
I think that's fair.
You get 57,000 tons. I guess maybe it gets bumped up if they go to 5.4 instead of 6% concentrate. But would you be looking to use your...
To shandy it in? Our lithium sulfate? Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I mean,
it'd be pretty handy because it almost has no cost.
Yeah, I guess that's my point. And is this part of the Chris Reed master plan, or is this just kind of a happy circumstance? I mean, I've always kind of viewed you as somebody that is playing chess when a lot of other people are playing checkers, and I don't think there are a lot of accidents. So, I mean, this to me makes perfect sense. It's just, I don't know at this point. You guys need to focus. You need to execute on the recycle and then grow that. Timing-wise, when you look at the recycling you're doing and building out the first commercial size plant and then growing that and then getting into the hydroxide business, the EU's talking about wanting to be regionally sourced. There's virtually no lithium in Europe that's going to come out anytime soon. And I'm not going to get into a pissing contest about Sinovex, but I mean, if you were going to rely on Finland, which I think is what the EU minister was touting Finland, I mean, that's a 10,000 ton plant tops, and you'd need about 25 of those to be where their 2030 target is, as far as being able to satisfy, if they were going to have 30% of the market. So how does the mind of Chris Reed mull over that whole European circumstance, and where do you see yourself fitting in various pieces here?
Right. So, you know, if you work on the basis that 35 gigawatts capacity in the mega factory needs about 35,000 tons of lithium hydroxide, sort of give or take. So you're going to have those EV plants in, or the battery cell plants in Germany and elsewhere in Europe, sucking up about 500,000 tons of lithium hydroxide. Now, presumably as the producers of the more expensive cars on a price basis, they can compete pretty well in an open market and source that. So they're getting all these exotic elements in to Europe. And you've got BASF and Umicore as big cathode makers. You've got the cell plants on a lag basis. You're going to have all these chemicals available for recycling. And so for us, I mean, look, if you're a miner, the only long-term defendable strategy is to be in the lowest quartile. We couldn't be there on a global cost curve in spodumene. And we might get halfway if we execute well on the hydroxide. If we're in battery recycling, we will be the lowest point on the cost curve for lithium. It will just come out. It won't matter what the price is. It's entirely margin because all the money's made off the cobalt and nickel. And so what we want to do is essentially partner with the Germans and launch what I would call it a blitzkrieg. You get a big German partner to build big plants. Like SMS aren't there to build 20,000 ton plants. I want to build 200,000 ton plants. If you're sitting in there with Volkswagen, you're going to have to build 500,000 or 1 million ton plant. We have big ambitions for that. And hence we, you know, some guys, oh, well, you know, you're giving away half the farm. I'm like, really? I'm pretty sure my half just grew by significantly more than double by partnering with these guys. Relationships, and you have to sit down and work out how much you do want to invest. It's on the other side of the world. And so look, we're very, very happy with the deal we're struck. As we said, I can't see where the lithium goes from 1 million to 2 million tons. We can see the impact on nickel. We can see the impact on cobalt. Cobalt's a byproduct from copper and nickel production, right? In my mind, there's not one decent primary cobalt mine in the world. Now, nickel, the de rigueur to make nickel is to get LME metal and dissolve it in sulfuric acid, hence it trades at a premium over the LME nickel price. Now, the nickel market sort of bifurcated. There's only a certain percentage that can go into the batteries, and literally I can't see how it doubles. I mean, we've got a significant package of lower grade nickel mines, you know, sitting at 1.7, 1.8% nickel sulfide, you know, all close to a concentrator and a refinery and stuff. But at 14,000, it needs an incentive price to get into the market. And that incentive price is a multiple of what it is now. So for us, we took a long-term view on nickel, and we wanted to sit down and understand, not nickel, on lithium, and understand the supply chain. And it's from understanding that that's led us into recycling, targeting cobalt initially and then nickel. And now we're very comfortable where we're at. Whether you look at nickel, cobalt, or lithium, and you exclude the byproduct credits and just put in the primary product, for nickel and cobalt, you're in the bottom cost quartile. And like I said, the lithium is essentially a byproduct. For us and our shareholders, we think that is the safest way to play, because notwithstanding the market is in a lull now, it won't be there forever. The only certain thing is change, and change is increasingly likely to be upward every day.
Help me with the recycling math. If you're talking about a 200,000 ton plant, is that the shred material that goes in, or I mean, what the 200,000 tons of
that would be the cell. So that's the cell feed, either prismatic pouch or
So if I'm looking at, I can basically go to the chart that says how much of that cell is cathode by weight, and then basically take the constituents out by saying NCA is this much of this and this much of that, or 811. On a 200,000 ton plant, you got to have a bunch of those to start moving the needle on lithium. You got your work cut out for you.
Yeah, I mean, a 200,000 ton plant, by my recollection, would be at somewhere about 15,000 odd LCE.
Yeah. I'm not casting aspersions.
Oh, no, but yeah. It'll just be a handy byproduct. I mean,
yeah. So how long, 10 years from now, how many 200,000 ton plants are they going to be? I'm just trying to look at.
Okay. So if you have a look at what it'll need, we'll need the available cells for shredding by 2030 is about 2 million tons of cells by 2030.
That's a significant amount of lithium.
That is.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, like you say, we can argue about the first million tons. If someone gets out the checkbook, Chile, Argentina, Australia, Africa, and Europe can deliver it. But I'm at a loss to work out where the, obviously you're going to have direct lithium extraction technologies scaled up, working perfectly, maintaining the water balance so that the regulators will let people suck and pull back more and just selectively pick out the lithium. You're going to need an electrolysis technique so you can harness the cheap power of the sun and electrolyze it and not be cutting reagents all over the world. And I mean, in equal part, there's a challenge to supply it, but the other part is we've got to do it with a lower carbon footprint.
Yeah, well, so, I sat with Tesla when they were looking at Symbol in 2014, and we had a whiteboard, and they were drawing the, okay, you go to Wyoming, you get Trona, you get soda ash, you ship it down to Antofagasta, you move it up the mountain to Hombre Muerto, you move it back, you go to North Carolina, you make hydroxide out of it, you go to Shikoku Island, Japan, you turn it into NCA, you take it over.
Over to Oakland and Steve.
It gets really ugly really fast. So now this is, I think you may be the ESG poster boy before this thing is all over. I don't know. When you start talking about regionalization, that is a big part of the answer for Europe, given their dearth of lithium resources.
And look, you've got to remember that the first iPhones came out in 2007. We've had laptops with lithium batteries in them for a decade. There's significant volumes now of LCO, which is pretty valuable. Now, that'll become less relevant as we start getting more EV production scrap and then end-of-life EV. It'll get swamped. But if you have a look in at Europe, Umicore's at 7,000, 8,000 tons, the big ones, and there's a few of them. We're just bringing in a new paradigm by saying, look, here's 20,000 tons. And we can scale up for the car making guys and the cell makers for whatever you need. Like if you've got a gigafactory and they make the cell makers or the car makers compulsory recycle. Like if you're in California, you sell a lithium bearing product, you got to take it back, you got to recycle it, or fund the recycling of it. Now, that will come, that'll get rolled out, and that will get written into law at some point in the future. And then all these car makers are driven by their CO2 footprint. Volkswagen wants to have a carbon neutral car. Now, with an EV, the carbon, the big gap between that and the ICE is the battery. And that's the supply chain of virgin mine, more, you know, rocks in Australia, up to China, over to Japan. You got cobalt up into China, manganese, nickel. We actually have to head that way. And for us, economics, ethical supply, closing the chain, all of that's great. But then there's been this new ESG. And unfortunately for us, it just fits in that. I'm not sure we ever went out to be a poster child, but equally happy to have you acknowledge it. So thanks.
We would like to thank our sponsor, Zolandez, who prides itself on providing a new way of doing things in the lithium brine space. Recently, a junior lithium explorer in Argentina was able to save up to 20% in their exploration costs through the use of Zolandez technology services. To learn more, visit Zolandez.com. That's Zelandez.com.
Well, let me ask you another question then. Because you've been in the lithium business for a while, and you know the challenges of getting to battery quality, and everybody that gets in the recycling game probably isn't going to be able to, at least on the lithium side, because it's the, you know, you're viewing it as a byproduct, I think in your case, rightly so. Can you see yourself or some other partnership that you have becoming the home of making battery quality lithium chemicals in Europe from the other recyclers? It doesn't have those skills.
Absolutely. In part, I don't think the Europeans want Africa and Australia to send them up rocks. You know, we send them 7 tons of rock. They'll take the lithium out. There'll be 6 tons of rock still there. Now, Europe's not a place that you can leave that volume of waste. But in equal parts, if you make lithium sulfate and you ship that in, I mean, the Europeans are used to getting different chemicals and improving their value. So the Livent concept of setting up costicide purification or carbonation, costicizing plants in China and taking industrial and technical grade material and turning it into battery grade, you know, for us, it makes sense. And I think for the Europeans, it makes sense. They will be much happier if you ship a chemical producer a pure lithium sulfate solution and all he has to do is carbonate or costicize it, but to make it fresh so that it can go straight into the cathode. And so at this stage, we model to sell a lithium sulfate, but in equal parts, we could add a modest circuit, or we could partner with, and there are guys that can do it and have done it before.
Okay, let's take another stroll down technology lane. Solid state batteries, lithium metal, different processes for making lithium metal. Are you tinkering with that, those ideas? Because sulfate can be it doesn't have to be lithium chloride. And
actually, one of the leading ways is to turn lithium sulfate into lithium sulfite to go into these lithium sulfur batteries. Now, yeah. The normal way to do it's lithium hydroxide. The Albemarle guys have got a pilot plant up in Langelsheim, I think, producing about a ton a day of lithium sulfite for lithium sulfur batteries for the EV producers. And they're running these cars with lithium sulfur batteries around Europe now. It's coming. Are we tinkering with it? I got to tell you what, when we're in the R&D phase, and we got batteries from aggregators to make feed for the Hydromet plant, I would get the odd bill for a new lab scale jaw crusher and I'd be like, or hammer mill, and I'd be like, well, what are you putting in this thing? And like, it'd be a lithium polymer battery. So she's got the lithium metal with the polymer in it, but you stick that in a hammer mill and crack it open and expose the lithium metal. I mean, that used to be the triggers on the atomic bombs. You know, the side, no one ever got hurt. So I'll be quite clear about that. But I tell you what, they will involve a different, I mean, we've got multiple redundancies now for lithium ion. We would have to spend a bit of time on on the lithium metal batteries, that would require a different level of diligence.
I know how your mind works, buddy. I'm just thinking you're probably connecting those dots. So tell me, in the scheme of all this, then you're talking about making a hydroxide plant with a partner in India.
Correct.
And take us through that.
Yeah. So look, you know, we've retained offtake rights from Mount Marion. You know, if you're going to use the concentrates in use to produce hydroxide, that's why we retained it. We'll need to supplement that clearly with some additional feed. It looks like the market might be a little bit awash for it, and I'll be getting it cheaper than I originally thought. So that's good. And so moving to India, so we sat back and had a look and thought, well, you've got 1.3 billion people. They are one of the largest users of mobile phones and laptops. And the government has a clear desire to get off oil and move to EVs. And they've since had a few little bunnies with their neighbours. And they want a domestic lithium industry and a domestic battery industry. And obviously the cornerstone to that is lithium conversion. And the government's very proactive. And so our partners, Manikaran Power, are the third largest power trading. They're very large in renewables. They're the arm of a big civil construction conglomerate. And they're very well connected, based in New Delhi. We're sort of like, well, you know, it makes sense. You've got good car makers. Obviously, you've got Tata there. You've now got Apple looking to move some of its assembly to India away from China. China has got more expensive. I think it'd be fair to say it's a little bit more difficult doing business there, especially as it relates to technology and stuff like that. So I think massive amount of Fortune 500 companies are in India. Even our little mates Livent have got, I think they've got a bully plant.
Actually, Dr. Reddy's and Ranbaxy and Pharma, they've been significant for a long time. And yeah, we had a Bully operation over there. And So
I recall it had an unfortunate domestic name that someone clearly named that from Pennsylvania and didn't check what it meant in the local dialect.
Well, that is not the first time that's happened.
Yeah. So look, with that, we've picked a beautiful site up at Mundra, which is India's largest port. Everything that you would need is there. I guess it's not unlike Mount Marion in that we missed the first window, but we had all our approvals. We had all the contracts ready, and all we needed was to get the offtake. And we'd been to the altar with Zhao Shen a few times, but finally consummated it in 2015. And so again, we'll go through the studies, we'll get the approvals, we'll do all the front-end engineering and all of that stuff after the feasibility study, and we'll be ready. And we got rock, but we'll be ready. And when the market's ready, then we'll jump through the hoop.
Okay. Well, I think we'll leave it there, except for a few rapid fire. You got a waiver on rapid fire last time. I don't know. I guess we didn't start doing that until maybe episode 5. I don't remember.
I think I'm having technical difficulties.
Yeah. Yeah, I think.
Bad internet connection.
Read my lips. Hey, when I did the podcast with Ken, I don't know what happened that night. I think maybe there was Netflix festival that slowed down the internet, but he was frozen the entire time. Right. I could hear him. So your connection's been great. So this is an easy one. What's the best advice you've ever been given?
The best advice I've ever been given. Walk into a room and ask for twice what you want.
Okay. I think in any
negotiation.
Yeah. Okay. Best day of your life.
Oh, best day of my life. Probably the day I got married.
Yeah, I mean, you either got to say that or when your kids were born. I mean, you know, it's just
that preceded the kids.
Fine.
We'll go back to the cause.
First principles. Okay, if you couldn't live in Australia, and you're a well-traveled man, what city outside of Australia would you live?
That's an interesting question. I've always found around the Bay Area, up on Muir Beach, would be nice. Always enjoyed my time in San Francisco. I think probably the weather, the fact that we have California bungalows in our seaside communities, I reckon that'd probably be my pick there. I've always found New Zealand to be much like Australia. You know, Auckland's just like a smaller version of Sydney.
Yeah, really? I guess if I go to New Zealand, I go to the South Island.
The South Island, it's like Europe. You know, they call Dunedin the Edinburgh of the South. I mean, you can literally be swimming and then go up to the Alps and be skiing on a glacier and then come back down the other side and have a swim all in the one day.
Yeah, no, I've been there a few times. All right.
And they play rugby, so.
Yeah, well, hey, my last guest was a Kiwi. And
yeah, well, God still wears a black jumper.
Okay, I'm not getting into intramural rivalries. Anyway, Chris, thank you very much. Hopefully next year we'll be able to see each other face-to-face, because I don't think it's going to happen this year, because it doesn't seem like we're going anywhere soon. But
your lips to God's ears.
Well, at least your kids are able to go to school in school. That's something.
Well, it keeps the parents sane.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's part of the logic here, is that kids need to be in school, because having them stay home has created a lot of second and third order negative consequences. But anyway, I don't want to get political. So thank you, my friend. And okay. You too. We will talk to you soon. Thanks.
All right. Keep safe. Bye.
Thanks again for listening. To those of you who have listened past Rapid Fire, I am making a special offer. If you go to globallithium.net on the contact page and leave me a note, the first person that does that wants a 30-minute Ask Me Anything call via Zoom will hear back from me, and we will arrange a time to talk. And with that, I will leave you with a closing thought. Don't let your memories exceed your dreams.